A podcast of the cinema.
And an example of American greatness.
As we celebrate our freedoms.
Well, you're saying it in a funny, hokey hick way, but I am saying it in a very real and sincere way.
Okay.
No, it's like the thing on Twitter, Stephen Colbert.
Oh, what?
Is like, send me examples of American greatness.
Oh, I see.
Well, here we are.
Okay, I'll accept that mantle.
We are American film critic greatness. Homosexual husband film critic greatness.
That's right.
We boldly saw into the future of the diminishment of journalistic jobs.
Opportunities. We're small business owners.
And now we're a small business.
Dang it. You are Dave White. I'm Alonzo Duralde. We both write for The Wrap. I'm also the film critic and TV recapper at What the Flick. And we do this program.
I'm kind of annoyed at everything right now.
Well, I hear you, but what specifically?
Well, the... So, I consulted multiple recipes and cooking times for this pork shoulder.
Yes.
And it's a 4.5 pound pork shoulder.
Right.
And all the recipes said 6 hours in the oven, just low and slow, till it gets to 180 degrees at a 250, 275 temperature. 6 hours. Nope. It has been in the oven for 3.5 hours, and it is finished.
Are you sure our oven was low enough?
Here's the situation. Our friends don't come over for dinner for another 2 hours.
Yes.
So I've had to wrap it up in foil, put it on top of the oven to keep it warm.
It's still cooking.
Technically.
Right.
I guess, you know. But it's not going to get up. It's not going to get any hotter.
Yes.
It's just going to stay...
Where it is right now.
Where it is right now. But, come on. How could every one of them be wrong?
Are you sure our oven isn't... I mean, we have an old oven.
No, our oven's fine. Okay. Believe me. It's, you know... It's old. And
you know the quirks.
And it wiggles back and forth with temperature, but no, it stays reasonably consistent.
Are they assuming that you have your oven on in an air-conditioned house?
And what difference are they going to make?
I don't know.
It's not going to make a difference.
The extra heat? I don't know.
It's not going to make a difference.
Then I don't know. Everyone's wrong.
I mean, it's going to... listen, I just tasted it. It tastes fantastic. But it's not going to be...
And you have a meat thermometer. Yeah. You're not serving trichinosis on the hoof.
No,
or anything.
I am not.
Okay.
It reads 180.
I believe you. I just know I didn't want listeners to be concerned about...
No,
you know.
They should not be concerned. I'm a professional half-assed home cook.
Okay.
And I know what I'm doing a good 35% of the time.
Well, it'll be great. That's all that matters.
Speaking of pork shoulder, Oakjaw open.
Ah, yes. And we have not stopped eating pork because of
listen,
this.
I love to eat a pig. And yet at the same time, as a child, my favorite book was Charlotte's Web.
Yes.
My first grade teacher.
Still one of your favorite books.
Miss Rose. She was my first grade teacher. That was the very first book that she read aloud to us chapter by chapter in first grade.
Right.
Each day, right after lunch, was reading time.
Dear kinder trauma.
Yeah. And she read that book to us, and the minute she was done reading it to us, I was like, mine. I went and I got it at a library, and I read it again. I just started it over. I read it again to myself. Because I was reading before I got into first grade.
Right.
I was very gifted.
So advanced.
I lost those gifts later on.
Yeah, I peaked early.
I kept reading. I read it again and again and again and again all through elementary school. Until Harriet the Spy took over, but that wasn't until fourth grade.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
I somehow never read Charlotte's Web as a child. Yes. I grew up with the cartoon version.
Yes.
The Hanna-Barbera feature film.
Inferior, and I knew it even as a child. Because I had read the book three times already by the time that movie came out.
So you're the 10-year-old who's like, book was better.
The book was better. Guess what the book also wasn't? Full of singing.
Yes, well.
Anybody singing in that book?
I read it as an adult. You finally made me read it, and it is quite lovely. I liked it very much.
It will make you cry.
I cried. Yeah, totally cried.
Make you cry. You know which movie version of that will make you cry?
The other one?
The Dakota Fanning version.
I still have not seen that one.
It's lovely.
Something about Julia Roberts as Charlotte, it just seems like...
She is a better Charlotte than Debbie Reynolds was.
Really?
Yeah. Here's why. Debbie Reynolds had a lovely ladylike quality to her voice. And Julia Roberts is mean. Think about that.
There's no nonsense.
Think about that. Think about Debbie Reynolds and her general niceness and sweetness to the world.
Mm-hmm.
And think about Julia Roberts. And think about Julia Roberts in a junket interview with junket press that she barely can stand.
So it's not exactly Julia Roberts yelling at paparazzi who are driving
after
her.
It's Julia Roberts being short with you.
Ah.
And that's how she approaches Charlotte.
Okay.
As better than everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhat annoyed by everyone's
needs
and lack of competency. She is a much better Charlotte.
Okay.
And I'm not even insulting Julia Roberts by saying she's mean. It's the quality about her that I like the most. It's the one that comes through in the media from time to time.
Yeah, you get a little peek.
Like, you get a little peek at Julia Roberts. She is not nice. I don't know who she's nice to, but even when she's nice to her friends, I bet you they're all like, come on, just be mean, because that's the most entertaining version of you.
No, they probably fear it.
No. No. Because they're comfortable in their friendship with her. Do you think Oprah's afraid of Julia Roberts? No.
Oprah's not afraid of anybody.
Oprah and Julia are tight. And they are not... They're not... When Oprah says to Julia, say something mean, and Julia just does it. Because when Oprah asks you to do something, you do it.
I love the elaborate relationship you have worked out.
All of this is in my mind, but it's true and a fact.
This is like when Wendy Williams talks about like having pot roast.
Friends in my head.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think Julia Roberts is a better Charlotte than Debbie Reynolds.
Okay. Yeah. I will watch it at some point, and I will report back if you are right or not.
And here's the other reason I think that she's a better Charlotte. That's how I read Charlotte in my head as a child. At 6 years old, I read Charlotte as imperious and demanding.
That's a fair cop. Yeah.
And in my head, that's who she was. And in my head, that's who I thought a competent person would behave like.
Oh, great. That's been your role model all this time?
Yeah.
That explains so much. So Oakjaw.
I'm quite nice. Yeah, tell people about the Oakjaw.
So this is Bong Joon-ho's latest film, the Korean filmmaker who gave us Snowpiercer and The Host and Mother. And it is premiering on Netflix globally. So if you are listening to this program and you have Netflix, you can watch this movie.
Right.
If you are in one of the few places on Earth where you might be able to see this projected on a big screen, maybe do that.
Maybe. I'm going to interrupt you for just a moment. Full disclosure.
Yes.
I did not see this on a big screen.
Right.
After all my talk last week with Manola
about...
Last week, Manola Dargis from the New York Times was our guest.
Talking specifically about this movie as an example of why Netflix should put their movies in theaters.
I was like, I'm going to see this in a theater. And then I learned that it was playing in one theater in Los Angeles.
Yes.
And here's the problem. a friend of ours had gone the day before.
Yes.
To this theater to see Okja.
Yes.
And he told me about this theater. I won't name the name of this theater. You can look it up if you want. You live in Los Angeles. A dine-in theater.
Yes.
Now, this friend is skinny. And he said, their seats are very small and narrow. And I felt the edges on my sides.
And apparently half your lap is taken up with like a perma tray.
Half your lap is a permanent table where they serve you your chicken wings or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Mozzarella sticks.
I can get mozzarella sticks at the AMC.
I know you can.
Okay. So the thought, and he said, also he said that the sight line from these seats is uncomfortable and weird.
Well,
because
the screen is
so close that you...
From the less expensive seats.
Yeah. If you want to sit in
there's
the
like
super
premium and super premium or something.
Do you know how much a super premium ticket seat costs at this movie theater?
How much?
Like over $25.
Oh my God.
It's nuts.
And that's not including the food and drink that you're supposed to be buying,
the food
too.
And drink.
Oh my God.
It's like being in an airplane in this theater. The seats are too small, and if you're not paying the premium price, you're up close to the screen, and your head is jacked up at a weird angle. And that is what this friend said.
And either way, you have to pay extra for food and drink.
And I thought, screw it. I'm not doing it that way. I'm going to stay home and watch it on Netflix.
Yeah, and had we...
We have a nice HD television, not like one of those old-timey TVs.
Right.
We have one of the new-timey TVs, like... Okay, like everybody else.
We were late to the game.
We were actually quite late to getting one. But it looks beautiful on Netflix.
And had we not been going on KCRW on Friday, you could have waited a couple of days and seen it
at the
New
Beverly, where it started this weekend.
I think, maybe.
Playing in 35mm.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. But
so if you live in Los Angeles and you want to see it on a screen, you could go to the New Beverly and see it on film.
Yes.
Yeah. Even though I think it was shot digitally.
It was. Yeah. It had to have been because there's so much digital effects work in this movie.
Yeah.
It is about a young girl in Korea who is one of 10 farms around the world that are raising this crop of super pigs been created by the Mirando Corporation.
Mm-hmm.
Any resemblance to Monsanto is, I'm sure, completely intentional. that is run by Tilda Swinton, and if you saw Snowpiercer, you know that Bong Joon-ho and Tilda Swinton love to goof on Tilda Swinton's teeth when she's in one of his movies. So at the beginning of the film, she's got braces, and she is very excited to announce this to the world, to the press, that this is going to like solve the world hunger problem and create delicious pork and yada da da da. So cut to 10 years later, and the girl and the pig are very happy together, and they love each other very much, and they romp around the hillsides, and the pig poops into lakes that I was thinking, maybe the pig should not be pooping in that lake. That lake might have potable water in it or something, but oh well. Anyway, so the people from Mirando come to collect the pig, and they bring Jake Gyllenhaal, who is this like TV animal show host, who's kind of the face of this campaign.
Yeah.
And Jake Gyllenhaal is giving the kind of performance that people give for international directors who are making satires in movies that are not their first language.
Yeah.
It's a little much.
It's
a lot much.
His performance reminded me of everyone's acting style in The Christmas That Almost Wasn't. Which was a hideous movie.
It's featured on the new season of Mystery Science Theater 3000, if you've never seen it.
It's back in the day, they used to make these international, you know,
productions
that were children's films, and whatever language it needed to be dubbed into, it was dubbed into that language.
I suspect that it was done in the way that you hear like Fellini and a lot of people do in these movies, where everybody spoke in their own native tongue, and then it all got dubbed later, or everybody just spoke gibberish so their lips were moving on camera. Like Valentina Cortese's character in Day for Night talks about how she would just go through a scene saying 47, 3, 13, 22, and then she would dub it all later.
Well, all the dubbing and all the gesticulating was always just like, hello, I'm here in the room, and that. And that's Jake Gyllenhaal in this movie. And I love every second of what he's doing. I know people are angry about his performance.
I am not.
But I think the people who are angry about his performance are the people who think that you should behave like a human being. And I don't think necessarily that that's all what you want in a movie.
Let me say, well, we'll get to this, but I would say I'm fine with not behaving like a human being if everybody else in the movie is on board with that. There's a lot of, there's about 18 different performance styles going on here. But
yeah.
Anyway, so they come to collect the pig. The girl is distraught, and she chases them to Seoul and eventually winds up going to New York with the pig, where apparently they're going to have this big sort of pageant and parade to celebrate things. But
and
But then, of course, there are other more nefarious agendas at play. Yeah. And yes.
Some so animal liberation front.
Yes.
People.
Yeah, there's a whole, like, radical...
highly entertaining animal liberation front
yes,
people.
Led by Paul Dano and Lily Collins.
I'm gone.
No, anyway, so it's kind of a it's a human animal love story adventure. It's also a an anti meat satire. It's a lot of things, and I loved watching it. I was never bored by it. It is a lot of things from a masterful filmmaker, but it is dizzying how all over the map this movie is. And if you're okay with that, you will enjoy yourself. I certainly enjoyed myself, but I did leave kind of thinking, what did I just see?
It's gorgeous, and it's moving, and there's always a sense of surprise.
And the digital Oakjaw character is amazing.
It's beautiful, yeah. The pig, she's a lovely big giant pig hippo dog. And Swinton is here, being two characters.
Yes. Hail Caesar gave her the flavor of twins, yeah, and now she's doing it again.
Yeah, she's doing it again. It's not making me into a vegan, but it is. It takes the premise of Charlotte's Web and asks you to just sort of take it all the way. Like, well, what are you going to do?
What did the Zuckermans do with the other pigs?
Yeah, did after Wilbur grew old to a ripe old age and died, did they never have any other pigs again? Did Fern grow up and, you know, decide, oh, well, I was a child, that was my pet pig, and, you know, we live in a hog farm and whatever.
Well, Fern in the animated version is voiced by Pamela Ferdin of The Beguiled.
Pamela Ferdin.
Who is now a super animal rights activist.
That is correct, yes. And so it asks the questions of Charlotte's Web. It interrogates Charlotte's Web. Thank you.
Oh, you academic.
So, I think it's delightful.
It's fascinating.
It is delightful.
It's fascinating and entertaining. I just...
And it is for children. Let's just say it. It's for children. And here's why. It's for children because they need to hear the F word and they need to see weird, brutal animal mating.
Yeah, that's the thing.
They need to see.
Like,
it'll toughen your kids up.
One of the first movies I saw in a theater was Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, and it does have that creepy boat ride scene, which I'm sure scarred me as a child.
Terrifying.
And toughened me up as a child at the same
Terrifying,
time.
Yes.
The scarring stuff in this movie might be a little too scarring.
I think that this, while this is clearly an R-rated fantasy vegan Charlotte's Web whirligig for adults.
Yeah.
Show it to the kids.
I should point out,
I'm shocked that Nick Lemire didn't watch this with
Christy. I should point out that neither of us are parents, so we don't have any judgment.
But we would be great at it.
We don't have any judgment as far as this kind of thing goes. If Christy says not for kids, I trust Christy. She's an expert. I really like this movie, but at the same time, I'm just mystified by it because, like I said, you've got the little girl, I believe her name is Sohyun An. Giving a just beautiful, natural performance, mm-hmm. First time, you know, in front of the camera.
She's like a Dardenne kid.
Yeah, I mean, like, fine, maybe her performance was put together in the editing room or whatever, but, I mean, she comes off completely naturally.
Oh, I didn't say that.
No, I'm saying
okay.
that you often hear that about child performances, especially from non-actors, that it's it's put together in the editing room. And I'm not saying that as an insult to her. That's just a lot of times what happens with a first timer who's young. In any event, the results are great. She gives it's a lovely, you know, straightforward performance. And then you've got super like Disney villain cartoony, you know, Swinton and Gyllenhaal running around. Then it's kind of like, I would like these performances in a movie that were pitched to accommodate them, but the movie that I'm watching is more about the girl, and so I don't know where to buy into you two. But then, like you said, the movie is this sort of like weirdly Disney but for grown-ups movie. It's bananas, but I'm glad I saw it, and I would tell people to see it.
It has a Snowpiercer quality to it, that sort of anything can happen.
Yeah.
Quality. It reminded me, in terms of how sort of giddy it can be, it reminded me of The Host a lot.
Because I think of The Host as being like this fairly straightforward family drama that then happens to also have a kaiju grafted onto it.
It's a monster movie at the end. Yeah. No, that's, I liked it.
All right. Okay, yeah, no, people should see it for sure.
What's next?
Well, I saw, speaking of children's films...
Right, and I did not.
Despicable Me 3. Yeah. I've never particularly liked this series, but even people
Which
who...
Which is why I should have been at this.
I know. Even people who do, though...
I love the Minions.
I love the Minions, and there weren't enough Minions in this movie. That was one of my big problems.
And that is what
it
gives me pause.
The Minions... Okay, so... Do you even remember what happens in Despicable Me 2?
Why should I?
Well, that's the one where he marries Kristen Wiig and becomes a good guy. So at the beginning of the movie, he and Kristen Wiig work for something called the Anti-Villain League, and they're chasing down this guy named Balthazar Bratt, who's voiced by Trey Parker, who is this sort of washed-up 80s kid star who becomes a supervillain, but like maintains a very 80s aesthetic. So every time he's on screen, like Take On Me or, you know, Into the Groove is playing. He wears this like purple, like Prince colored purple, you know, jumpsuit with giant shoulder pads that hide weapons. He's got a mullet and a bald spot. He was one of my favorite things in the movie. There wasn't enough of him either. So they're chasing him down because he's stolen this giant diamond and he gets away. They get fired from the Anti-Villain League, which has a new person running it played by Jenny Slate. And they set up that character so much that you think, oh, well, she's going to matter later. Nope. She fires them and is never seen again in the film. So then they're trying to figure out what to do next. The little girls are worried about where the, you know, how they're going to be supported. So like the youngest sells her beloved pet unicorn, which is a big deal. And then suddenly Gru gets a mystery note that he has a twin brother that he never knew about. They were separated in childhood when their parents got divorced. So the whole family goes to Fredonia. No Groucho Marx as Rufus T. Firefly, unfortunately. And so it turns out that the brother, Drew, has a full head of hair, but is a totally incompetent supervillain, which they find out was the father's profession. And I guess Gru grew up with his mother telling him he was worthless, and apparently Drew grew up with his father telling him he was a lousy supervillain. So
I see.
Drew wants Gru to teach him how to be a supervillain, and of course, you know, Gru has reformed, so he instead pretends to go along with it, but really he's just trying to get the diamond back from Balthazar Bratt. Meanwhile, there's some minor adventures with the daughters, which again, like, they set up some things and they never bother to follow through with them. The Minions, meanwhile, after Gru and the wife get fired from the Anti-Villain League, are hoping they're going to go back to villainy, and when Gru says they aren't, they all leave, and then they all wind up getting arrested, so then they all go to jail, and there's, like, wacky hijinks with them in jail and escaping jail, but not enough of the Minions. So there are bits and bobs along the way that I thought were funny and cool and, you know, visually interesting or whatever, but overall, it's kind of too many things thrown at it and not enough follow through.
They will send this to us at the end of the year.
They will.
And I'll watch it then. Like, everyone's telling me there's not enough of the thing that I like the most.
Yeah. Because, you know, they gave us a whole Minions movie.
That's correct.
And so it's like, all right, well, y'all opened that door. So now you can't just, like, take them back.
And the reason they gave us a Minions movie is because everybody likes the Minions.
Yes.
You don't have to give a damn about Despicable Me or whoever.
This is not rocket science.
Everyone likes the Minions. They're a delight.
Yes.
So, while we're waiting for Minions
2.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Okay.
Did you ever see Secret Life of Pets?
Did I?
Because I did not.
I don't remember.
I've almost watched it on a plane like twice, but I just somehow can't get excited about it.
Why don't you watch it on the plane when we go to Atlanta?
Maybe. Maybe I will.
I'll be asleep.
I know you will.
Got my sleeping pills all lined up.
I will be sitting behind you, watching you drool.
You can't see me drool through the seat.
If I hold a mirror up.
Also, interestingly enough, while I am sleeping upright in an airplane seat, I do not drool.
Hmm.
I do when I'm in bed at night. Wake up, that pillow's got a little spot.
Okay, the house.
Okay, so, Will Ferrell and Amy Poehler are a comfortably upper middle class couple.
Yes, in the suburbs.
They have a big, beautiful kitchen. This is something I notice in films all the time. Who has a big, beautiful kitchen in films? Almost everyone, unless they are meant to be a poor person in an indie film, and then they have dirty dishes in their sink.
And a hot plate.
And a hot plate, yeah.
Or, of course, I mean, everybody gives it a hard time to Nancy Meyers about the insane kitchens in her movies. But, like,
speaking of drooling.
There's a lot of, like, pretty bougie kitchens, even if they aren't going to those extremes.
Yeah. Yeah, these people have the kind of kitchen that a Nancy Meyers character says, you know what, I want to upgrade.
I need a bigger one.
I need it to be bigger and more luxurious. It's the beginning
of its complicated kitchen, not the end of its complicated
kitchen. But in real life, in actual life, this is a kitchen that you would kill someone for.
Yeah, this is almost at a Kirk Cameron's Saving Christmas level kitchen.
Two ovens in this kitchen. Two ovens. F you and your two ovens.
Amy Poehler doesn't bake a single thing over this entire film.
No one is touching them. When I see two ovens in a TV
show... Nor does Will Ferrell, I should say.
When I see two ovens in a TV show or a movie, I think, kill those characters now.
And give me their ovens.
And give those ovens to me. I'll put them to good use. I was complaining about this just yesterday on Linoleum Knife and Fork.
How can you braise some celery?
How can I braise oxtails and braise celery for the braised oxtails and braised celery recipe from Nancy Silverton's Mozza at Home book at two different temperatures unless you have two ovens?
Maybe we could ask our neighbor.
We have to become very good friends with him first.
Clearly.
He just moved in.
Yes. Start working on that.
All right. In any case... the reason that I'm harping on this is because this is a very strange premise. The premise is that, in spite of the fact that they have a sweet house in a nice neighborhood, and they both have jobs and they're both making money, they have somehow magically spent 18 years raising a child for whom they have not saved one dime for a college education. Not even a little bit.
The movie,
not a penny.
The movie's flimsy premise
is
that they assumed that the daughter would win the annual scholarship that their suburb gives, where they pay for the complete...
Did they think this was going to happen when she was three?
Exactly, yeah. That's a lot of eggs in one basket.
Right.
Where the top student at the high school, the suburb, pays for their entire college tuition.
Yes.
Problem this year being that Nick Kroll has decided that instead they're going to spend the money on building this amazing new town pool.
And in reality, you find out he's been embezzling all the money. Okay, so, which is not a spoiler because nothing in this movie is a spoiler.
Yeah, it's all
because
stupid.
This movie is stupid. And so, they, Amy Poehler and Will Ferrell, instead of doing what a normal family would do and say, well, we're going to get you some financial aid, we're going to sign you up for student loans that will turn you into...
It will haunt you for the rest of your life.
You'll go to debtor's prison afterwards, but at least you'll have a college degree.
Yes, you'll be the smartest indentured servant of them all.
They don't mention this option even one time. They do go to their bank to ask for a loan for themselves so that they can give her the college education that she desires. But all the bank person says is, I'm not lending you a dime. No reason.
Yeah.
No reason given. They've got collateral. They could mortgage that really nice house with two ovens.
I think there might be also a quick throwaway line of like, we're barely keeping up with our mortgage or something.
Yes, well, you're not barely keeping up with your mortgage. You're fine. You are fine.
Move to a condo with one oven and send your daughter to college.
And so the so at that point, the movie ceases to become anything tethered to reality at all. And they open a casino in their home to make a lot of money.
Well, in Jason Mantzoukas'
home. In Jason Mantzoukas' home, who lives across the street, and he's their neighbor. And he's recently divorced from, or getting divorced from Michaela Watkins. And blah, 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 blah. This is a stupid, badly made, lazy, meaningless film. But.
Not without its laughs.
Sometimes you're feeling stupid and meaningless and lazy. And it's the summertime, and you want to go to an air conditioning place. This is still not a good option because it's only 80 minutes long. And
I mean, granted, AMC will give you 20 minutes of trailers.
Still not enough.
Still not enough.
Transformers to the Fifth is 2.5 hours long, plus those 20 minutes of trailers. You want to take a nice AC nap for 2.5 hours? You go see the Transformers.
And bring earplugs.
Yeah. Here's the upside. It's actually quite funny.
Weirdly enough,
I mean,
for a movie that is a complete mess and lazily strung together and haphazard, and again, I mean, even like in a way that this is the bad version of the Oakjaw thing of like, this scene does not go with this scene, or this performance does not go with that performance.
It stumbles and falls into each new setup.
I did laugh occasionally, which is, you know, nice for a comedy. And for a movie that wasn't shown to the press, it's certainly not the, like, utter disaster that the studios made us think it was going to be by not showing it to us.
Yeah.
But it is... It's a lot of nothing. You know, I mean, I like I said, there are some laughs in it, and when you watch it on cable, you might think, oh, this wasn't that bad.
Yeah. You'll watch it on HBO or a plane, and you'll laugh because there's a lot of funny stuff in it.
Yeah,
it's just about nothing.
Yeah,
it is a series of goofy sketches about this one story.
Yeah,
and it's got a cool supporting cast. Every single person in this movie is a comic actor that you've seen before in other places, or a stand-up that you maybe kind of sort of are starting to know. A lot of up-and-comer kind of people.
Yeah, like Alison Tolman, who if you were one of the...
Kyle Kinane.
The not enough people that watch Downward Dog or the first season of Fargo, you know her.
The Cedric Yarbrough from Reno 911.
And Speechless now.
And Speechless. So...
I'm digging up some names because
I'll tell you the Mariah story while you're digging.
Oh, well,
names.
Yes.
If you do happen to go, you will notice toward the end of the film a poster for Mariah Carey hanging in the entryway of the house. The reason this is because over the course of the time that the casino is up, they start including all of these ridiculous
casino amenities
that you would find at, say, you know, the
Caesar's
Wynn,
Palace,
the Wynn or something, right? So there's a spa, and there's a stand-up comedy club, and there's a restaurant, and now there's a concert venue, and you're supposed to be thinking that Mariah Carey is going to come perform at the casino. Well, Mariah Carey was scheduled to have a cameo appearance in this film playing herself. But what I learned from watching Wendy Williams and then from reading on the internet, Mariah Carey was so badly behaved on the set, so unprofessional and so abusive, they say.
Yes.
That Will Ferrell, as one of the producers, had her chopped out of the film.
Yeah, like she showed, she did not want to sing the song they had previously agreed that she would sing, and she wanted to sing something else, and they didn't have the rights cleared for it, and it was just like one disaster. She was 4 hours late. She wanted stuffed lambs in her trailer, and yes, so it was like, all right, you're out. You're out of the movie. I wanted to mention Andrea Savage and Lennon Parham battling
Martha and Laura.
Yes,
the battling neighbor mean ladies who can't stand each other and who wind up in a physical brawl. But their every moment of antagonizing each other is really funny.
Yeah, they give each other those like when Kristen Wiig would do that the
seething character.
Yes.
Yeah.
Judith. Sit down, Judith.
Yeah. Yes. So you're going to enjoy yourself when someone just puts this in front of your eyes for free.
Yes.
You don't have to go to a movie.
You do not.
It's not important.
No.
Yeah. And then the big movie of the weekend, Baby Driver.
Yeah.
Is it making money?
It is making money.
Okay.
It is making money. It is well reviewed.
Good for Edgar Wright. I like him.
It has a high cinema score.
Why don't you talk about it and everything that you hate about it? Because you are wrong, but you dislike this film quite a bit.
I'm an outlier. Yes. Yeah. Look, I went in very enthusiastic about it. I like Edgar Wright's movies, like some more than others, but I think Scott Pilgrim and World's End are both great. I like Shaun of the Dead a lot.
Uh-huh.
I'm mezzo on Hot Fuzz, but for the most part, I'm down for Edgar Wright.
While you are talking about this, I'm going to go check the vegetables that are roasting in the oven.
All right. So this movie premiered at South by Southwest to critical hosannas, and I was hearing like, oh, it's a car chase movie, but it's all about the soundtrack, and it's like an action musical, and they're like, okay, well that all sounds fascinating. Let's see what you got. And I just very quickly was not into this, and part of it was because there are no characters to speak of, and you know, obviously if it's a car chase movie, I wasn't expecting like super deep characters, but I want to at least have a tiny bit of interest in who's in the car, where are they going, why is it important that they get there, and I didn't get much of any of that from this movie. Ansel Elgort, who plays Baby, who is a driver, is exceedingly blank. I did not like him in his big breakout movie, which was the Fault in Our Stars. Thank
Fault
you.
Star.
I knew it was something Shakespeare. I couldn't come up with it.
Fault in Our
Stars. You know, and you know, he has this nothing romance with Lily James, who is playing like the idea of a woman. And you know, just to make sure that we adore Baby and know what a great guy he is,
mommy.
They give him a dead mommy, and they give him a foster father who is black and elderly and deaf and in a wheelchair. And it's like, okay, this is such a standard Hollywood formula where, like, if you need a quick shorthand to, like, make a character likable. A white character likable.
Yes.
You either have, like, kids who adore him, animals who adore him, or, like, an old black guy who adores him.
Yeah.
And so they just really overload this, like, isn't he great? Isn't he great? Look, deaf.
Right. Look, deaf.
Look, deaf. So, yeah, I mean, the car chases themselves are intricate and complicated, and
they're fantastic.
And they're well shot.
They're so much fun.
But I did not find them exhilarating in the way that a great car chase can be. I did not have a single moment in this movie that excited me as much as almost anything in Fast 5 or 6.
Okay.
And so, you know, yes, there are some deep...
Well, these are meant to be car chases that maybe could happen.
Sure. Granted. Even then, though, that's pushing it. I would not play the realism card here.
All right. Okay.
You know, yes, there are some deep cut musical choices, and, you know, good for you, Edgar Wright. You're clearly, like, into that sort of thing, and that's a selling point. No, I'm being genuine about that. It is cool to have, like, some obscure R&B, you know, implemented in a cool way. I love it when a movie trots out a song that's, you know, 40 years old that I never heard before, and it's like, oh, okay, that's cool. But I just didn't engage me. It did not thrill me. It did not draw me in. And I, as it went on, that didn't change. And I know a lot of people who, I felt like I was going out on a limb talking about this on the internet because people love this movie so much. And a lot of people are like, shut up, you're wrong, you don't know anything.
Shut up, you're wrong, you don't know anything.
There have been people who totally agree with me. There have been a lot of people who were like, I loved it for a while, and then Act 3 completely goes off the rails.
Right.
So not everybody loves this movie, but almost everybody loves this movie. So I understand that I'm in the minority, and if you like it, you know, bully for you, shoot an arrow in the air.
if it goes up high,
hooray for you. But I was not down for it.
I will preface this by saying that it is the Edgar Wright movie that I think I might like the least.
Okay.
However, I'm a big fan of this guy.
Mm-hmm.
I like all the Cornetto movies. I like Scott Pilgrim is my favorite.
Uh-huh.
But I really enjoyed myself watching this. I will give you the following. The characters are just vapor trails. Okay, there's... What did you say? Ansel Elgort could have been a...
Oh, broomstick with a smile painted on it.
Broomstick with a smile painted on it. Yeah. I don't know what the appeal of Ansel Elgort is other than being young and pretty in a way that young girls tend to like their boys to be.
Sort of non-threateningly.
Yeah.
One of my favorite tweets after the South by Southwest premiere was somebody saying, Baby Driver starring literally any white actor under the age of 25.
Correct. He has not shown himself to me to be something yet. Obviously, the camera likes him.
Yeah.
Because he's very attractive.
He's got cheekbones.
I liked that his pretty much every move was choreographed by an actual choreographer.
I like that in theory. I didn't think
I liked it in execution.
The play of it didn't work for me.
I liked Kevin Spacey, although this is a role that Kevin Spacey could be that
yes.
could do
blindfolded
with his hands tied behind his back. Jamie Foxx is fine. John Hamm is not exactly, but the so the characters are whatever.
Yeah.
But what I like about this film is the collision, no pun, of stuff. It's really energetic.
Mm-hmm.
It's got, you know, style for days.
Sure.
It looks so cool all the time. The soundtrack never stops. It's very loud. It's such a loud movie.
The part of the premise is that the baby has tinnitus.
Yes.
And the way he...
You'll have it when you...
And the way he keeps it at bay is by constantly listening to music at a really loud volume.
It carries itself with a swagger. It imposes itself upon you. And I felt carried away by that.
Okay.
And so... while I don't think it is a necessarily meaningful film, unless you want to stretch hard and say that this is about the way it is to be young and hustling all the time, it's a lot of fun. And that seems like damning it with faint praise, but I really found it to be a really sort of whole experience.
Okay. I would have been perfectly...
Minus the characters.
I would have been fine if I'd had fun with it. I would forgive the other, you know. It's interesting because, you know, Edgar Wright is on, our friend Amy Nicholson has recently brought the canon back, and she's been with a series of guests, and Edgar Wright was on this week, and they discussed Walter Hill's The Driver.
Yes.
And so you can sort of look at this movie as the hybrid between Walter Hill in The Driver mode and Walter Hill in Streets of Fire mode.
Yes.
You know, whereas, like, the whole... After the opening car chase, there's the closest this movie gets to a traditional musical, which is him walking down the street to get coffee and coming back. And it's all very choreographed and very set to music and like set to even, he's even interacting with sort of like the murals, you know, that he's walking by. They figure into the visual thing of the frame. And I just, and I was immediately like, oh, I see what we're going for here. And it's not, this is not working for me. And I just thought, maybe straight men shouldn't direct musicals.
But yeah, Stanley Donen.
But exactly. Stanley Donen, Gene Kelly, straight guys, and you know, Joel Schumacher made The Phantom of the Opera, as somebody pointed out to me. So, you know, I abandoned that thought, but it was the first thing that popped into my head.
Have we talked about Funeral Parade of Roses?
I don't think we have.
Have we mentioned it yet?
It is out in the world. We screened it at Outfest a year or two ago. It's sort of a new restoration, and it's now making its way into theaters.
Well, very specific theaters.
Well,
currently it's at Cinefamily in Los Angeles.
But I'd say
it may
like,
find its way into your big city art house somewhere, somehow.
Or like at least a museum screening or something, yeah. It's out in the world in the way that like in the way that a 1960s Japanese movie restoration reissue is going to get to you.
Yeah. Toshio Matsumoto is the director.
Yes.
From 1969. It's a kind of a loose, well, not kind of loose, exceptionally loose adaptation of the Oedipus Rex story.
Oh, okay.
About a boy named Eddie and his love for a drug dealing, you know, brothel owner, and then the woman who runs it, she's sort of competing with him for. There's no plot. It is a Japanese New Wave based on what you learned from the French New Wave, combined with experimental stuff. They actually name check Jonas Mekas in this film,
and I hear Kubrick quotes it a lot.
In A Clockwork Orange. The title is in reference to the Japanese word for rose, which apparently translated comes across as the same word in English as pansy. Which is why it's about, you know,
a gay relationship,
the gay subculture in Tokyo. It is visually stunning. It is this swirl of images and juxtapositions, and it's all black and white, but you can feel the sort of Kiet Vu Pali Magoo quality
fun.
Of it.
Okay.
If it feels like I'm having a hard time describing it, it's because it's hard to describe. It's a visual experience more than it's a narrative experience.
Okay.
And it has this perfect renegade outlaw queerness that for 1969, who was doing that?
Right.
You know, in the United States in 1969, you had the Boys in the Band, which was, you know, its own thing.
Right. Pretty trad.
But what you also had was stuff like The Gay Deceivers and Some of My Best Friends Are, which were, you know, films about tragedy.
Yeah.
Ultimately, they're about the tragedy of being queer. In this movie,
I mean, you had Kenneth Anger.
You did have Kenneth Anger. I'm not saying that this didn't exist.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that
as far as mainstream features go,
in the moment, you know, there wasn't a lot. And this was one of those things that was a whole lot.
I really want to see it. I didn't get to see it at Outfest, and I don't know that I'm going to get to catch it at Cinefam. I may have to wait for the Blu-ray.
Yeah, obviously there's a kind of, you know, fatality to it all, where you're sort of like, well, you know, we're cast outs from society, and we're going to live this way, and we're going to die this way, and,
right,
you know. But it makes you think that being gay and Japan in 1969 would at least look really rad.
if nothing else, visually, it's great. I didn't really... I had just come from there when we recorded last week's episode, but I didn't really get a chance to talk about it. I went to the New Beverly to see... They've been doing their kiddie matinees where they are showing sort of family-friendly films. I had never seen 1980s Flash Gordon projected before.
1980 or 1982?
1980.
Okay.
So I went, and I had a good time. It's a little stodgier than I remember. I hadn't seen it in a while. I remember it being more fast-paced. It's a little... Right. There are moments where it's kind of like, you know. Because it's written by Lorenzo Semple, who is the guy who wrote the Batman 60s TV series and the movie. And that was those things moved, you know, like they were just like scene to scene, like things were happening constantly. And this one kind of like, it sometimes takes a while to get to where it's going, but it still, it has that same similar kind of tongue in cheek quality. And visually it's just cuckoo bananas. Like there's a scene where, you know, that somebody in his one of the bad guys, like Klaatu, is summoned in the spaceship,
right.
And this panel opens and this mattress that he's lying on sort of like comes up to make him like vertical, and he talks a little and he's like, all right, I'm going back to sleep now, and he goes back down. You know, just nutty stuff like that. It was weird because we were talking about, we each went to the New Beverly recently, and the connective tissue is that Mike Hodges, who directed Flash Gordon,
yes.
Is better known for like these British gangster movies. Like
right.
He did Get Carter with
right.
Michael Caine, and then not that long ago did Croupier,
yes.
Which was like Clive Owen's first big movie.
And I saw a British gangster movie.
Yes.
I saw in 1980s The Long Good Friday.
Oh, also 1980. Oh, funny.
Yeah. Shot in 79, you know.
Yeah.
Starring Bob Hoskins and Helen Mirren. Bob Hoskins is a boss
mm-hmm.
who is finding his world coming undone, and he doesn't know why, and he doesn't know who's doing it. And it's all happening at the same time that he's trying to strike a deal with some American investors to take his business to the next level of boss.
Oh.
But it probably won't happen because the people who keep trying to kill him keep killing everyone around him instead.
Ah.
And as it happens, you realize just what a fragile man he actually is.
Hmm.
Because he is mortified by what's happening. Trying to scramble and keep a good face for the investors, saying, oh, no, this is just a little problem. It's a little, don't look over here. There's nothing going on over here. Let's go to dinner and talk about money, you know. And Helen Mirren's joining in. She's like, oh, I don't know why everything just exploded. We must have a gas leak, you know. Like. So there's this weird sort of like dark death humor going on.
Right.
But it's not a comedy. It is really about a man whose world is crumbling
mm-hmm.
in the space of 24 hours. And he's not prepared for it, he's not ready for it, and he is flailing against it with the kind of rage that really, just Bob Hoskins.
Nobody did it better.
What a dude he was. And his performance is impeccable. I have not seen this film since early 80s on HBO.
Yeah, I remember watching TV. It on cable back
yeah.
in the day, but I haven't seen it in a long time. I haven't seen it on Elisa in ages either.
Never seen it projected on a screen until just now. And there's a lot of cool cinema going on as well, just entrances and exits, and there's a scene in a meat locker where men are strung upside down waiting their deaths. That's fantastic. But mostly this comes down to Bob Hoskins' performance, and it's just truly magnificent. There's a reason he became a star, you know, in spite of the fact that he was a character actor.
Yeah, he's a hairy fire plug.
With a character actor's mug. And then there was the audience.
New Beverly.
I don't know how. Listen, most of the people who go to the New Beverly are fine people, and they don't act like idiots. I applaud those people, and I'm glad they're there. But I sat next to the idiot and his girlfriend, the kind of guy who goes to the movies at the New Beverly to explain movies to his girlfriend.
No.
And she adores him so much that she's like, tell me more.
Mm.
And so he does. Even after the film begins.
Because
they're doing this. Murmur, murmur, murmur. Tee-hee-hee, giggle, giggle. Murmur, murmur, murmur. Not audible enough to really cause a fuss, but not silent enough
to not be
to
bugging
not
you.
Make me notice.
There's something about boy nerd spaces.
Yep.
I remember for a long time, and this might still be a thing, where women would talk about not feeling comfortable going into comic shops.
Right.
Because they were, like, not taken seriously and just sort of, like, there's something about, like...
Leered at or ignored or condescended to.
Exactly.
Are those the three?
Those are the choices, basically. It's,
yeah.
Okay. Remember when Twilight started going to Comic-Con?
Yes. Yes.
And how they all lost their business.
Yeah. No,
like,
I do.
Not their business. They still went. But like the boys were so.
The boys lost their minds.
Were so freaking out that like girls were in their clubhouse.
Yeah.
Ah.
Yeah.
There's something about the New Beverly that attracts an aggressive film.
There's something about repertory in general.
That's
true. We won't single out the New Beverly.
You're right. I've seen it in other places,
too. It's just
that
we encounter it at the New Beverly because we go to the New Beverly.
Yes. No, I've seen it at the Egyptian. I've seen it at CineFamily. Like
yes.
Yeah, you're right. There, repertory cinema attracts a certain level of know-it-all who needs to make sure that everybody around them knows that they know.
That they know things.
Yeah.
Okay, so here's what this guy didn't know. That it's okay for him to look at a naked man's body and not react out loud to it. Because there is a shower scene in this film. Bob Hoskins is experiencing grief. Something has just happened. That's very bad. And he's got blood all over him because of it. And he goes home and he showers. And it's a long, slow shower scene. And the camera is on his body. And you watch the blood run down his body into the drain. And the guy starts laughing. Because he has to let you know that a naked man in front of him is only the subject of comedy for him. He can't be looking at a naked man's body and not react in any way, or that means maybe gay might find him and catch him and crawl up his butthole and turn him into a homosexual.
Like the Kandiru fish.
Yes.
There's something so weird about that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I remember going to a press screening of Brokeback Mountain.
Yeah.
I saw it at the...
I know what scene you're going to talk about.
I saw the screening in Toronto and the audience was rapt and, you know, loved the whole thing.
Yep.
The scene in Brokeback Mountain where after they have been separated for a while, when Jake Gyllenhaal comes to visit and Heath Ledger comes downstairs and the two of them start furiously
lunge at each other
in like the parking lot of the apartment building, women all start giggling. I'm like...
I wonder what that's about.
I don't know if it was that they were laughing at it or just like so uncomfortable or so like taken aback.
I was thinking you were going to say men were
giggling. Women were.
I don't know what that means.
Yeah.
But ladies who are listening, would you like to explain?
But it's that thing though of like where you are where you're so caught off guard and just so like, oh my God, this makes me nervous.
Well, maybe. Maybe that's that.
Yeah, but it's just such a strange response.
Yeah. I don't have a DVD this week.
Sure you do. Something that we, you know, pick a Bong Joon-ho.
Go get that Shirley Clark box that I talked about last
week. No, you did that one. That was your DVD.
No, do it again.
Classic. No.
Yeah.
No, say different one. Again. No.
I don't have one.
The Host. The Host is your DVD pick.
Okay, sure, The Host.
And
I did not prepare my brain for this.
Okay, and mine is The World's End, which I think is my favorite Edgar Wright movie. I like that a lot.
Okay, Letters.
And you don't have to see the other two Cornetto Trilogy movies to get it.
Letters. But before Letters, I want to talk about a Facebook... Well, there was a Facebook comment and there was a Twitter comment about The Beguiled, and I want to circle back to that.
Okay, sure.
And both of these comments said the same thing. And they were this. Instead of erasing the black characters from this film, the slave characters from this film, or rather, the slave character and the idea that one of the female cast... in the book is mixed race.
Yes. Which the first movie also erases.
If that's going to happen, Sofia Coppola needs to explicitly state in interviews that she is making a film all about white people and say the word white.
Yeah, that she's interested in the lives of white women.
Because white is not without...
Neutral.
White is not neutral. It is not...
Default.
It is not default. It is not without race.
Yeah.
Your story is about race no matter what race your characters are. Because everyone has a race.
So, I also like somebody on...
And I like that idea. I like the idea that if you're going to make a movie that's all white people, you have to say it. You now have to become responsible saying the word. Yeah, I made this movie and it's all white people. Like Woody Allen has to say this forever now.
Yeah, no, I'm for that.
He'll never do that.
I believe it was Ms. Platypus who pointed out that, like, you know, no, what she should do is work harder and, like, maybe hire some consultants who will show her how to do it.
Or hire consultants that will help you.
Yeah.
That's the thing. She could have done that.
Totally.
She could have done that.
And if I sounded...
And not bruised the focus of the film. Sure. I know last week I said I like that it's a single focus kind of film. Yeah. And I do. But I also think that, yes, she could have done this without bruising that bruising that thing, and could have made it richer.
And if I sounded blasé about it, again, I saw her version first,
yeah,
and had no idea that this slave character even existed until I saw the Don Siegel one, and then I later even found out about the other character in the book. So it's like, I have to say, as somebody going in tabula rasa, I didn't miss that character,
right,
and I didn't think to myself, oh, this is a film that's set during the Civil War. How can there not be slaves? You know, it's like they say the slaves ran off.
Fair
I'm
enough.
Like, well, yeah, when the war started, in a lot of cases, I'm sure they did. I think that once the war started and, you know, things were in upheaval, in a lot of cases, I think slaves did manage to escape. So I bought that in the context of this story, and that's the thing.
In any case,
yes, I'd say in the larger picture, and particularly given that this was an adaptation, and that's a deliberate choice on Coppola's part, she could have played that better.
As we move forward in the world and in cinema, I think it's going to be important for white filmmakers who are making films entirely about white people
to cop to it,
to own that, because we don't live in that world. We don't live in a world that's just white people.
Yeah,
like we don't. You and I don't live in an apartment building that's just white people,
right?
And so it's like it doesn't make sense.
Yeah,
don't pretend your movie is reality.
If it's going to be that curated.
Exactly. All right, here's some letters. This is from K, the letter K.
Mm-hmm. It's short for JK.
I'm sorry, Casey.
Ah.
Yeah. Or is it Kelsey? I'm having a hard time reading this.
Grandpa, put them cheaters on.
Hang on. I'm seeing an L. I think it's a Kelsey.
Okay.
Kelsey. Long-time listener, first-time caller. I have not seen my cousin Rachel, but your Claflin point that this is the first time you have noticed him intrigues me. I did not notice him until their finest. I'm sorry, I'm laughing because I saw their finest earlier this year.
Yeah, I love that movie, and we forgot that he was in it.
Which was indeed fantastic, and which I also saw upon this podcast's recommendation.
Oh, good.
I literally did not even realize that he was the same guy.
Well, in the...
Who had been in all that dreck previously. I have been curious about whether I could still find him interesting on screen outside of their finest Buckley character now that I know who he is. It sounds like I will. I was on the fence about seeing this, my cousin Rachel, but if you find him even more captivating in this than in their finest, then I will give this one a shot. Well, that's me, not you.
Yeah, you're more into this movie than I, to my cousin Rachel, than I was. Yeah, I mean, the thing about Claflin in their finest is he's wearing glasses and he's very much like making himself look more like an average Joe than his usual sort of like movie star looks.
Yeah.
And so I kind of forgot that he was in their finest. He's quite good in their finest, and he is, but I was not thinking about it when we were talking about my cousin Rachel, because my cousin Rachel is the first time that he's been giving an interesting performance and turning on the star wattage.
Yes.
You know, in their finest, he's giving a good performance, but sort of, you know, hiding his light under a bushel.
Yeah. Yeah, he's giving you man
my cousin Rachel.
Yeah.
For sure.
This is from Cindy.
Mm-hmm.
To Mr. Duraldi and Mr. White, regarding your review of my cousin Rachel, I expect to see the cineast term sweaty boner danger in the next edition of a biographical dictionary of film. Thank you for expanding my understanding of film. Incidentally, my favorite sweaty boner danger film is Body Heat. Sincerely,
oh, yeah.
Cindy.
That is sweaty boner danger.
Hello, Frank. My friend Frank.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Hey, guys. What are you talking about?
Hey guys, just writing to say how much I love the show and all the extra content I get now that I'm not a freeloader. I'm particularly enjoying LKF, that's Linoleum Knife and Fork,
mm-hmm.
a food podcast hosted by two film critics.
Who like to eat.
There's no rhyme or reason for why this should exist, and yet it does.
Mm, go figure. It's the hummingbird of podcasts.
And I hope to catch Linoleum Nights in real time, eventually, I suppose, since I don't want to waste everyone's time, that I should ask you a film-related question. Do you feel like the last few years have seen a proliferation of overzealously music-supervised movies?
Mm, boy, howdy.
That is, movies that use licensed music to beat a plot point over the head or as a crutch to prop up a weak plot. Yes.
Yes, no question.
I guess the two most recent and egregious examples I can think of are Suicide Squad.
Oh, yeah.
Which felt like the writers put an iPod on shuffle and tried to write a story based on the playlist, and Kong Skull Island, whose song choices were so on the nose that it took me out of the moment. Run Through the Jungle in a Vietnam-era movie? Groundbreaking. Anyway, I was wondering if you had any feelings regarding this. Yes, we do. We hate it.
Yeah, it's a dreadful practice. I'll tell you, for whatever problems I have with Baby Driver, again, great song choices, great song curation going on, and not the usual suspects, whereas they don't get any usualer than the ones in Suicide Squad and Kong Skull Island. Both of those movies are just so lazy.
I remember the moment in my life when I realized that a song in a scene could be stupid.
Forrest Gump?
Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Well, that movie was stupid anyway.
Hang on.
Oh, I think I know what you're going to say.
Obviously, it is the film musical version of Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, starring the Bee Gees
and Peter Frampton,
and Earth, Wind, and Fire, and
George Burns,
and lots of
Alice Cooper and Aerosmith.
Yeah, all these people. And everything was going along ridiculously. I was, I don't know, 13 or 14, 15 even maybe when I saw it. I don't know what year it came out, 79?
I think so.
Ish, okay. Yeah. And I was going on 15. And I remember thinking, well, this is a silly thing. And then Golden Slumbers.
I knew that's what you were going to say.
comes along in the film because Strawberry Fields,
who's a character,
is a character. She has died. And they carry her casket out.
The pallbearers.
Juxtaposed to the moment when, in the song Golden Slumbers, the chorus goes, "You're going to carry that weight." And I was like, is that what they want? Did they mean to do this? Did they actually mean to do this? Because this is not just silly. This is almost offensive in a weird way.
This is not what the song is about.
Yeah. You're going to carry your girlfriend's coffin out of the church?
A long time?
For a long time. Yeah. But then Carol Channing shows up and sings this closing song with everybody. You forget about it right away.
Yeah, if you've never seen Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, it merits a look because it's just... It is one of the prime examples.
Oh, you should see it.
It is a prime example of cocaine cinema.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my. Frank closes his message with an LGBT-centric Pride Month, because we are only 2 days out of Pride Month now. For us tonight, here we go. Tangerine.
Love it.
Carol.
Love it.
Happy Together.
Love it.
Paris is Burning.
Love it.
How to Survive a Plague.
Love it.
My Own Private Idaho.
Love it.
Orlando.
Love it.
Victim.
Love it.
Moonlight.
Love it.
But I'm a Cheerleader.
Oh, we were doing so well.
Don't love it.
No.
I don't like it.
No.
I didn't like it when it came out. I didn't like it when it was... No.
No.
I even interviewed Clea DuVall for a magazine when that movie was out. For that movie. And I sat through the whole interview. We had a great conversation about everything except the movie. Because I was like, I don't like this movie at all. I'm going to just talk to you about Yola Tengo, which was great because she was right on board for that. But she was also supportive of the film. And we talked about the movie for like 10 seconds.
Sure.
Enough to make the article be about the thing it was promoting.
Right.
No. Cheaply made and poorly made, I was not interested.
Yeah.
On any level at all.
Well, you are 90% knife.
Frank, you are 90% knife.
And
guess what?
Several of those films on your list are now showing on Filmstruck.
Yes.
Introduced by me.
Guess what else?
What else?
We have to stop reading letters and finish this podcast because I have to go tend to the dinner.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we'll do that then. All right. As always, thank you for listening. Thank you, Blue, for our wonderful theme music. Go listen to all of his stuff. He is so great. And you can find him online at bluetopia.com, BLEUTOPIA. Say, if you were wondering about that letter that mentioned Linoleum Knife and Fork and Linoleum Knights and all the extra content.
Okay, TV.
You want to get your hands on some of that, go join our Patreon page at patreon.com/linoleumknife.
Money, 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 money.
Find out about all the extra shows and...
Not much money.
And lovely prizes that we offer. No, it's a crazy bargain.
Are you already a subscriber? Guess what? This summer you're going to get all your stuff.
Yes.
It's all still on order. But all the merch that you get, if you're at the right level of subscription, you're going to get that stuff.
It is happening.
Don't panic.
It's totally happening. go check out our friends on the internet. Go to ChristyLemire.com. Listen to the B-Movies podcast and Cancel Too Soon, hosted by Bibbs and Whitney. Check out the B-Movies podcast. Sorry, I said that. Check out the Schmoes Know, Dennis Enun with Dennis Hensley, The Sewers of Paris, The Comics Canon. I'm going to be on the Sofa Dogs podcast again very soon, doing a feature-length commentary for Hudson Hawk with host John Pavlich and my friend David Kittredge, who is also a fan of the movie. And also give a listen to the Criterion Cast, Fat Guys of the Movies, Film Spotting SVU, and Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to the show for free at iTunes, and do leave us a review there. It helps so much.
5 stars.
Make it 5 stars.
Don't waste my time with anything less.
You can also leave positive feedback for us at all the places that we stream, including Stitcher Radio and TheLounge.com and Google Play and CastBox and Podbean and a whole bunch of other ones. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at LinoleumCast. Drop us a line at LinoleumPodcast@gmail.com with any questions or comments. You can also PayPal us $22 at LinoleumPodcast@gmail.com.
Would you like
for
a t-shirt?
Our fabulous OG black t-shirt with linoleum knife and white letters across the chest.
Yes.
If you live outside the U.S., it costs more than $22, so email us first and let us know where. We'll tell you how much.
You're talking so fast.
Otherwise, PayPal us. If you're within the United States, let us know what size you want and where to send it. And y'all are great. Thank you for listening. We will catch you next time. Happy July 4th.
Goodbye.